You have rented my mouth to say something to you. Now, I mean, I don't have any image that I know anything you don't, so that cuts me out of that one. So then what is it you want me to say? Well, the interesting thing I've begun to notice over the years is that what you want me to say is something you already know. And how do I know that? Because I say something infinitely wise that only the wisest people would understand, and you nod. Okay? So if you nod, you know. And if you know, why did you need to spend $20 to hear me tell you what you already know? So I've thought about this as a reasonable question, since I do this so often. And I realize that what we are is in the predicament of having to say over and over to ourselves, it's like the old stories, the kind of spiritual essence of our being. We have to just keep reminding ourselves, and we come together for this process, and we all need it. I need it too. I see in the audience many people who may not be as old as I am, but have memories. And I would just ask you, hasn't the journey been interesting? Hasn't it been fascinating? I mean, it actually blows me away to have survived. First of all, or survived in this form, and second, to get to the point where I really appreciate and enjoy the whole process. That's taken years. And it's been an interesting journey for me from inside my consciousness, not in terms of just the social events on the outside. So that I could watch my mind go from Western psychologist, professor, with a model of reality that said, psychology's real. And I teach it as real. It's absolutely real. And then there's the psychedelic period after the mushrooms in 1961, when I then say, it's relatively real. And that, as I see it, is the major thing that happened. That I went from a culture I'd grown up in that saw everything as absolutely real. Like, I learned Newtonian physics as if it was real. Then Einstein came along and said, it depends on where you're standing. So then I went through a lot of interesting stages. After I first got high, saw through the veil of who I thought I was, to appreciate who I was, or who I am, or who I will be when I finish being who I thought I was. If I move too fast for you, just raise your hand and tell me, because either we all go or no one goes, actually. When I found I couldn't stay high, no matter how well I used my technical skills, but that I always came down, and that took years. But then I realized that. And then I went to India to see, because I had been introduced to all of these incredible maps from the East, from Buddhism and Hinduism and Taoism and Zen and all these different things, that showed me that while we were busy achieving external excellence, there were other people who were cultivating a very exact and articulated description of inner states. And I saw such delicate descriptions of the inner states that I was finding indescribable by Western cultural words and language, that I realized that I could read these maps, but something didn't happen in me when I read them. And I realized maybe I was standing in the wrong place. That is, if you've been acculturated to see reality a certain way, and then you read a book, you impose on that book your acculturation. And so maybe I was in the wrong, standing in the wrong place. So I went to India hoping I could find a map reader, somebody who could decipher the maps for me. And whom I was graced to meet was Neem Karoli Baba. And after he had taken 1,200 micrograms of acid and nothing had happened, because when you're in Detroit, you don't have to take a bus to Detroit. I realized that what he had done was just shown me that he had freed me from a method, and he had showed me that it was possible for a human being to simultaneously be aware on all the planes of consciousness at once. Because wherever I went, he was always there. If I got high, he was high. If I was down, he was down. And yet he wouldn't ever allow me to grab hold of him with my consciousness. Like at one point I started to think, I've got a really cool guru. He knows everything. He's a miracle Baba. Great. So a friend of mine arrived from Canada who was a professor. And I said, come see my guru. Feeling my guru would snow him. So he came in, and my guru, who knew everything, said to him, hello, you're from the United States. The guy said, no, Maharaji, I'm from Canada. Oh, and you have three brothers. No, Maharaji, I'm an only child. And it went on like this until I was so mortified. And as the guy left the temple, he said, very nice guru you've got there, you know. And I went back steaming, and Maharaji was laughing. So he played with my mind. He played with my mind. It's delicious to find a playmate to play with your mind. Really, that's the gift of guru. That's the gift of wise friend. You know, my particular path has been one that I have been very reticent to speak about in the West, my spiritual path. And it's the path of what's called Guru Kripa, or grace of the Guru. And it just doesn't sell in the West for a lot of reasons. First of all, the West is suspicious of gurus, and rightly so. But also, we aren't comfortable about having spirit in human form. That's a complicated one for us. And the other thing that I didn't want to tell people, even if they got through all of that and had sympathetic joy for me, they would also, at some level, want the same thing. And my guru had left his body, and what could I offer? I had nobody to recommend. I mean, there were a lot of great ones around that other people said were, but I myself had not had an experience that would lead me to send them to another person. So I didn't want to hurt people, but then an interesting sequence has happened. So I just held on to my stories, and then in 1978, we collected lots of stories and published this book, Miracle of Love, which is 1,000 stories about Neem Karoli Baba, which don't create a human being at all, by the way. It's like pointless paintings or something. And people read that book, and they started to write letters to me with the pictures and the stories and saying, who is that guy? I've read these stories, and somehow I've opened myself, and he's within me. He's like around me all the time. Is this good? And I said, well, as far as I can see, from listening to people who are in the same situation as you, they talk to me about their relationship with him the same way as I feel in my relationship with him. Therefore, I must assume they are all my guru brothers or sisters, and that they are as connected with him as I am, since he's dead anyway. So I began to see that this whole business of, do you have a guru, do you have a teacher in flesh, was, it was absolutely delicious and wonderful and a great high, but it was not necessary. In India, they say God, guru, and self are one and the same. And it certainly seems to turn out to be that case. And some people get it through a devotional path to another form, Hanuman or Ram or Maharaji or whatever form, Christ, Jesus rather. And some relate through the formless. I watched in devotional yoga, these stages of devotional yoga, where you start out with a relational love, like you love Jesus, or you love Mary, or you love Krishna, or Durga, or whoever, Hanuman. You love them in a relational way, and then especially when you do things like chanting or all-night singing or something like that, and just keep going in and allow yourself to go into these really trance states, you come into these other planes of consciousness where you're in a different relationship to that being, where you and the beloved are just hanging out together. You're not any longer trying to get to the beloved. And then there is a period of just the most exquisite foreplay, where you're hanging out with God in whatever form your root is. And for a real bhakti, they want to continue the foreplay and they don't want the orgasm. They don't want the merging back into, they want to stay separate so they can enjoy loving the beloved. And actually, and there's one more stage, and that's where you merge with the beloved. And then you are the creation. You are what it, you are. You just are. What fascinates me is that we are all these levels at once. What fascinates me is with what short shrift I dealt with myself in the old days. I mean, when I do this old exercise I've done many times, where you put a tuner, a control knob next to your eye, and you tune it at level one, and you look up here and you see a 65-year-old paunchy, bald, handsome gentleman. Okay? And then you flip it one dial and you see me as teacher, as spiritual seeker, as da-da-da. You see me as Caucasian. You see me as on and on. All my psychosocial identities. That's who you see on Channel 2. That's as the world turns. That's where our personalities hang out. That's where we think our storylines are real. Okay. Then you go to Channel 3, where we're all bigger than life. It's the astral plane. And we all have our archetypal identities. And I'm an Aries, and you know what that means. And then we go one more channel, and when we look into the eyes of another person whom we just saw as their physical body, their psychosocial identity, their astral identity, you look in their eyes and you see from behind all that another being looking out at you. Are you in there? I'm in here. How did you get into that one? Okay. It's as if you see, it's as if you have brought your awareness back into your soul identity, and what you see when you look out are other soul identities. And then if you flip the dial once more, you see that those souls are all like jivatmans. They're all little parts of one thing. They're like holography. And you realize that it's looking at itself, looking at itself, looking at itself. There's only one of us here in drag. Now, it's interesting. You and I, from my point of view, exist as that one awareness. We also exist as souls who are aware of our predicament as souls. And we also exist as incarnates, as egos. And I'm using the word ego now to include your body and your personality and all the psychophysical shtick of channels 1 and 2. Okay. So you and I got born, which was in itself an interesting trip. But then, not to get delayed there, you and I went into training, and we went into basically somebody training. See, we went into training about how to be somebody. Now, you were trained by the best kind of people because they all thought they were somebody. Your mother and father both thought they were real, and therefore they thought their child was real. So you are surrounded by a consciousness in which your separateness is what's real. And you go into separate training. You're somebody. And you learn how to be somebody and get what you think you need. Because at first you think it's all one thing, and then slowly you see it doesn't always happen. Most people, when that happens, they get so busy. The somebodyness is like computer software for functioning on this plane, on this loka. Okay. It's our thinking minds. Once we are somebody, meaning we have a conceptual map of reality that includes who we think we are and who we think everybody else is, so we know a tree is a tree and a rose is a rose, then we go into somebody's special training. See? Didn't you? Didn't you? Then we get trained how to be somebody special. I was. I was very special. Everybody was special. And then for us, certainly us who are gathered in this room, something happened. It may have been lurking all through your life, or it may have just happened. But at one moment, or at some point, you awakened. And you can put those in many terms. You realize you'd been had. You realize you had been trapped in somebody-ness. Just in the same way as Gurdjieff talks about landing in prison. And he said, if you would escape from prison, the first thing you must realize is you're in prison. If you think you're free, no escape is possible. Far out image. So you awaken. And for me, that's what happened in 1961 with the mushrooms. And from then on, the game changes. Because at that point, your awareness has experience from other, what are now called non-ordinary states of consciousness. You have experienced reality from those planes, and you have known experientially that it's equally as valid as the plane you thought was real. Is this too weird? Are you here? Okay. When I first awakened, the feelings I had were, I'm home. This is so familiar. Where have I been all this time? How have I cut myself off from this thing? I've been starving to death, and here I was in an ocean of plenty. How bizarre. And then slowly everything would wear off, and I'd be back in it. But I'd have the memory of that. And that memory kept compelling me forward to try to get into that state and stabilize it. So Maharaji showed me that that was possible. And what I have done since that time, which is the last 23 years, is to do the practices and live my life in such a way as to optimize my stabilizing myself in an awakened state. Because as far as I can understand, that is the most compassionate thing that I can do. Now that has nothing to do with whether I'm active or not. It's how I'm active. It's how I'm active. Because what I have seen to my own horror is a lot of my best intentions as an ego to relieve the suffering of others has ended up increasing the sum total of suffering in the world. Either because I suffered more than they did in trying to, whatever. And I realized out of all that, that if I cared about the world, the earth, the other people, and I saw that I was the instrument, just like you are, I was the basic instrument through which social change would occur. Because as you see the web of interconnected information and consciousness, you see that as each individual in the system changes, the whole system changes. So I saw that I had to work on myself as a way of extricating my awareness from the exclusive identification with my ego structures, with my map of reality, with my identification with my desires, with my needs, with my wants. Not stopping any of that or trying to stop it or denying its existence. This is not Meshuggah stuff. This is the ability to extricate yourself from exclusive identity with those things. You don't push them away because then you just end up a horny celibate. You can't do that. It's a process in which you, best characterized for me by Mahatma Gandhi, his autobiography were called Experiments with Truth. And when he was on a train and it was leaving the station, and a reporter rushed up and said, Babaji, Mahatmaji, give me a message to take back to the people in the village. And Gandhi scribbled on a piece of paper and handed it out the window, and it said, my life is my message. I assume you're saying the same thing. I would like to be. I would like to have the integrity that everything I know to be true inside is manifested at all the levels outward. I'm not. But I see that until I am, every message I send is a mixed message. Every message I send is not only a message of love, but it's a message of fear. It's interesting. I work a lot with people that are dying. So I'm often with people as they approach dying. And often when I walk into the room of somebody that is extremely, that's suffering immensely, that has, say, cancer or AIDS or Lou Gehrig disease or whatever, ALS, my first reactions are often reactions in which my empathy for that person and the predicament they find themselves in is so great that I feel my heart being ripped apart by the pain of their situation. What I have learned to do is sit with that, not deny it, not try to push it away, but just sit with it. Until I quiet down and I find an inner center in which I then can rest in my own soul awareness, and I look out and I see a fellow soul who is in a different incarnation than I am. And it's an incarnation in which this person is going through this physical condition. But the soul is not going through the condition, the ego is. So when you meet a fellow soul, so when I meet, go into the room, my job isn't to say to the person who's busy suffering and in pain, say, hey, that's just your ego, come on up and be with your soul. Because I have no moral right to decide about another person's karma, they all have their own work to do. What I can do with my consciousness is create an environment where another person could come out and play if they chose. But if they didn't, blessings. You're impeccable in the role you're playing on the ego psychophysical plane. But you're also present on another plane. And I think if I could get the essence of what I have figured out in the simplest early stages of it, is that you and I should be living on two planes of consciousness simultaneously. Just two. I don't ask for the whole shtick. Just two. And you say, which two? And I'd say any two. Because the minute you can, whether you have lucid dreams, that's one way of doing it. One way you admit you are in a different reality and you go from reality to reality. Because what that does is it changes the meaning of any single reality. I've just finished a book called Aging Lightly, A Spiritual Paradigm for Conscious Aging, because I'm 65 and the boomers are turning 50. It's a great market. Okay. And I looked, you know what happened to me? I was on a train going from Westport to New York City, and it was a late evening train. It was in autumn, and I had been with my friend Judith Stanton. We had been out looking at the leaves and their height and of beauty. And now I was in this dimly lit coach in the evening, sort of glowing from the day. And the station was closed, so you bought your ticket on the train, and the conductor came along the aisle, and he said, tickets, please. And I said, I'd like to buy one from you. And he said, what kind do you want? And I said, do I have a choice? And he said, regular or senior? What went on in my mind at that moment will pass for the second. But what I said to him was, senior? But I said it the same way as when I was 18 years old, I went into a bar to order a beer in New York State. You know, beer? Like, would you serve me a beer? And he gave me the ticket. I said, how much is this? He said, $4.50. And I said, how much would a regular one be? He said, $7. And I was very pleased with that. It's not half bad. I mean, it's half price. So he gave me the ticket. He didn't ask for any identification. So then I held this ticket, and I realized that this was going to cost me more than $2.50, you know. Because here I had accepted a ticket to find, and it said on it, senior, see. And I never thought of myself being a senior citizen. How absurd. And it felt weird. And instead of pushing away the weird feeling like I did when I was 60. See, when I was 60, I really tried to milk it. I thought, I've been treating birthdays like nothing. I'll really make something out of this birthday, because in India, 60 is the year when you're going into the fourth stage of life, becoming sannyas, giving up everything. So I had three birthday parties. If I was going to give up everything, I was going to go out flying. And I started to plan how to gear down everything and, you know, turn my life around at 60. And after about 6 months, I didn't feel a thing. I was busier than ever, and I found myself putting it off. So I thought, the hell with it. I just won't do that trip. I'll just go on being ageless. But the 62 ticket got me. You know, and the way it got me was interesting. It wasn't that it got me because inside I feel I am any age. But it was because I was entering a new social identity. And when I sensed, as I later found when I did research and read Friedan's book, Fountain of Age, that the media, the whole economy is a youth-oriented one in which aging is treated in our society like some kind of dismal error. I mean, in a non-traditional society, you don't look to old people to pass down the lineage, because what do they know about surfing on the internet? So what you do is you have sort of obsolescence. Because in one of the societies that is focused on technology and scientific materialism, it keeps producing more and better and more and better. And it's newer and changes are faster and it goes to the young. And then at the other end of the game, as scientific materialists would like, we are figuring out how to lengthen life longer and longer and longer. So, I mean, you can see the obvious one. If a woman has a third of her life after menopause now, how interesting. If the culture defined women, which this one doesn't, but if it did define them as childbearing, the way in which aging is depicted in television or in the media. But what's happened at this moment, and why this conversation is relevant, I think, is because of the demography, the game has just changed. That the power now moves, the advertising dollar and the political vote now moves to old people. We can not only have kneeling buses, we can have kneeling senators, can have anything you want. See, and the interesting question is, which of the mythology, how, when you look at a dysfunctional mythology about aging in a culture, how do you get rid of it? Well, the way I see to get rid of it is to unacculturate yourself. That is, the culture isn't just out there. When you see an old person, you have a certain set of thoughts that are conditioned by your culture, that are in you now. They're no longer out there. You just have them. You've got to get rid of those first. In other words, if you're going to be free of a dysfunctional mythology that leaves aging as a time of sadness, loss, and fear, and irrelevance, certainly going to color the quality of your life. So what I saw in doing this book was that it was that what aged in us was one of the planes of reality we exist on. That is, our bodies age and our minds age and our thought processes age. But there are other planes on which aging is not a relevant variable at all, where you actually have experiences inside yourself of timelessness. You're living simultaneously in time and not in time. But see how busy the external chronology of days, months, hours, seconds, time, movement, past, future permeates your mind. In fact, when you look at old people's consciousness, since I've been doing that, you see that as people get older and their future gets grimmer, from their point of view, they flip into the past. So then they only tell stories about the past to each other. What they missed on the way through because of their panic was the present. And the present was their salvation. Because had they been able to come into the present moment, they would have gone right through the doorway into timelessness. Because in a moment, there is no time. Time is the relation between two moments. When you live in one moment, you're not living in time. Okay, new moment. There is a way for the soul to be conscious. And once you've started to awaken, this is all you're going to settle for. Where you are deeply involved in the storyline of your incarnation, and yet at the same moment, you are perfectly mindful and present and clear. It's a statement in the Tao, one does nothing and nothing is left undone. There's a place in you that's absolutely quiet and clear. And that doesn't in any way detract from the part of you outside that's doing and changing and all that stuff. Those are two different planes of consciousness. And to rest in two of them simultaneously makes you a reflective person rather than a reactive person. What intrigues me about the 60s to the 90s that I was talking about earlier is that what happened in the 60s and what happened with civil rights, with anti-Vietnam, with sexual freedom, with the environment, beginning of the women's movement, with gay rights, with on and on and on. I mean, that all blew up at one moment. It's as if something happened at that time, and there were many causes of it, I'm sure. Some of these things have been building for years, like the civil rights movement. There was some time when we shifted into a relative reality frame, and that freed us from being intimidated by the patriarchal, vertical, institutional structures that we had been living under. And they just began to look like paper tigers to us. And we thought at that time, it's so obvious how people are caught in their minds. Now that we see it, everybody will see it. It turned out everybody didn't see it. And that was the naivete of the 60s. It was the innocence saying, oh my God, we have been living in a mind structure. It's like in a mind prison defining reality this way, like Plato's cave or something like that. And you thought, this is so true. How can I not act according to this truth? And if it is true that I am also the soul and so is everyone else, and from this place we can clearly see what we're doing to the world and each other and ourselves and all that, and this all would change. Now, why doesn't that happen? Because a lot of people who had a big investment in their ego structures, in their power and their security, which is what you try to build when you feel like a vulnerable, separate little entity. Somebody didn't awaken out of their somebodyness. They are frightened at that moment because their somebodyness is up for grabs. And what happened in the 60s was it caught so close to what they perceived as chaos and anarchy that they forgot a lot of stuff in order to protect themselves because they felt the siege. And what we had was many years of the pendulum swing with President Reagan and President Bush. And the fundamentalists and the far right. And now, in the 90s, the pendulum is starting to quiet down. And the interesting question is, since many of us, for one reason or another, have an appreciation of the two planes of consciousness, soul seeing how it all is unfolding, ego dancing life. If we see that now, is there a way that we can share that kind of wisdom with our fellow human beings without scaring the hell out of them?
Please flip the tape now and begin side B.